Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Once considered the world's most divisive, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has long been overshadowed by many other hot wars, but it still continues influencing geopolitics in barely perceptible yet fundamental ways. Is a fair resolution even possible at this point, and can the Israeli-Palestinian stalemate offer any hard-won insights for the war in Ukraine? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from London by Daniel Levy, a former Israeli peace negotiator and president of the U.S. Middle East Project. Mr. Levy, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Oksana. Good to be with you.
Now, let me start with a newsy subject. That is Israel's old new Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu expressing his willingness and readiness to mediate the conflict in Ukraine, if all sides agree to that. Do you think Israel or this Israeli government in particular have solid peacemaking credentials or potential for that matter?
Well, it's an interesting way of approaching the question, Oksana. I don't think it's Prime Minister Netanyahu's credentials as a peacemaker that would possibly stand him in good stead to play a role in the Ukraine crisis. He, Prime Minister Netanyahu, may well disagree with me and say, look, I've done amazing things between Israel and certain Gulf and Arab states with the so-called Abraham Accords. But these were very much stitched together by the United States. And given that the parties involved were not actually in any conflict situation, I don't think this really falls into the realm of peacemaking. So I don't think it's Netanyahu's credentials as a peacemaker that open the possibility of him to have a role in this crisis. What may open that possibility, and I'd be very cautious in suggesting he has a role, but what may open that possibility is that he does have a long-standing relationship with President Putin. Netanyahu is a known figure on the international stage. People may remember that the short-lived premiership of Naftali Bennett, there was some sense that he might shuttle between the Russian and Ukrainian parties. I never took that seriously. I think if there is an opening for diplomacy, it might be that we can take Netanyahu more seriously because he has that relationship on the Western side and on the Russian side. I'm not sure the relationship with President Zelensky of Ukraine exists, and I think that could become an obstacle, but let's zoom out a bit and just recognize that it doesn't feel like we're in a negotiating, deal-making moment at the moment.
Well,
not
exactly. We are not there yet, but given your particular expertise in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I wonder if we ever are going to be there, given how many years it has taken. Now, I know that you've been instrumental to the 1994 Oslo Accords. Do you think the international community's perception of this conflict changed between now and 30 years ago?
I would just, not from a position of humility, but more even historical accuracy, I was involved in that, but not instrumental.
Okay. Well, you've been involved in that because I believe you believed in peace. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong in terms of my belief in peace. But I think sometimes frameworks ossify. Sometimes frameworks that were appropriate at a particular moment in history lose their ability to be relevant. And in that respect, I think we are already deep into a reality in which the architecture of the peace process is not fit for purpose. If there is ever going to be a peaceful outcome on Palestine-Israel, it will not be as a consequence of carrying on with the peace process, getting the parties to negotiate. There may have been a moment. I probably am on the side of those who think there was a possibility in the 90s. But that framework really now just serves to perpetuate the conflict. And I think it's important to recognize that when we talk about perpetuating the conflict, this is quite convenient for the Israeli side. The price for the Israeli side is minimal, both in direct terms of casualties, but also internationally, reputationally. Israel does very well economically, is expanding its network of relations. It pays no price for its occupation and illegal annexation. But of course, it's the precise reverse for the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So the status quo is quite unbearable for the Palestinians in terms of the conditions under which they live.
You mentioned in one of your articles that the so-called peace process to which outside powers, including all members of the UN Security Council, pay lip service, has entered a new level of disconnection from reality to the extent of becoming little more than a rhetorical device. Why do you think this rhetorical device is being maintained for so many years rather than recognizing the ugly reality as it is?
It's a very good question. Because it's convenient. Because if you are an actor in the international community who either does not want to link your bilateral relationship with Israel through its treatment of the Palestinians, because that is maybe politically contentious in your domestic politics, maybe it's just awkward in terms of commercial relationships, military relationships, technology relationships, then you stick with the convenient. And because the conditions of the Palestinians are not considered by enough people to be sufficient reason to revisit their relations with Israel, and they are not sufficiently disruptive, we have a very weak Palestinian leadership. Therefore, the convenience remains. And I think for other countries who perhaps look at that equation and say, that's not great. It's only going to get worse. It's explosive. It would be better if we could do something about it. They look at it and they say, oh, yes, I remembered. I have many other things that are a higher priority for me as a state actor, for my national interest. I'm not going to volunteer to step into the breach and lead on this. And if we're talking about the Palestine-Israel situation, there is a reality. There is a reality of America being very much the primus inter pares, the prime mover, almost having a monopoly on how the world relates to this situation. And America is neither willing to relinquish that role nor to use that role to hold Israel accountable and to advance peace.
Well, Mr. Levy, I do want to discuss American policy in relation to some other countries and some other conflicts as well. But before we go there, you mentioned that for many countries, it's simply convenient to go along with the status quo. Isn't it also self-gratifying to, you know, return to the peacemaking efforts once upon a time and to sort of earn some real good points of having tried to do something? I mean, is it simply a matter of it being, you know, so pragmatic? Or do you think in this case, perhaps these countries can also feel good about themselves, about actually trying to do something by not doing anything?
Well, precisely, Oksana, I think we're well past that point, actually. I think anyone who thinks they look good at the moment, as a consequence of perhaps occasional rhetorical flourishes of sounding like you're a supporter of peace because you may mention two states or call on the parties to de-escalate and negotiate, I don't think anyone looks good making that case set against the backdrop of the realities on the ground. If anything, and I will say this, I think the West, in convincing much of the rest of the world on the particular point around Ukraine and Russia's actions in Ukraine, I think one of the problems for the West is the rest of the world looks at this and says, why are you applying one standard in this conflict and you're ignoring those standards in other places? And I think Palestine is very high up there on the list of examples of where you do not apply the same standards.
Well, I think if you say that the world is well past the mark when it could genuinely approach any peacemaking efforts on the Israeli-Palestinian question, I think we are way past any qualms about the double standards. I mean, I don't think anyone questions them at this point of time. They have become so obvious. But going back to Israel, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Israelis' policy over the last couple of decades has been based on the premise that the realities on the ground, be it settlements or cross-border strikes, are more important, more sort of vital for Israel's position than any international public opinion. Putting aside your personal views on that, don't you think that that has been an effective policy, especially given, as we have discussed, somewhat pretentious stance of the so-called international community?
Well, I think there are two important points in relation to that, Oksana. The first is that, you know, I do want to make clear that you are, of course, absolutely right. You know, breaking news, double standards. Of course not. We're very, very used to this. It doesn't mean that there is not an intrinsic value to international law, whether it's applied to Russia's illegal actions in Ukraine, America's illegal actions in Iraq, Israel's illegal actions in the occupied Palestinian territories. We pay a price as a community of nations, as citizens here of this planet, when we are so cynical in our collective approach, each one in their own, where it's convenient, yes, where it's not convenient, no. In the specific Israeli-Palestinian instance, this is exactly the point. The point is that the Israelis have looked at this and they've tested the proposition, can we get away with it? And the result of the test has consistently been, oh boy, yes, we can, at very, very little cost. Mm-hmm. And so when people say to the Israelis, you can't, inside the Israeli internal debate, we can't do that, the world won't accept it. The lived experience of Israelis is that every day you can violate international law, you can settle, you can entrench, you can impose massive permanent restrictions of freedom on Palestinians, and the world exercises its vocal cords at best, but does not practically lift a finger to hold you to account. And until that changes, I think we can expect things to only get worse and perhaps much worse. It may be that the change is violence. This is what, if law and nonviolent means don't do their job, then violence becomes the recourse. And armed resistance is, of course, part of any conflict.
Well, Mr. Levy, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to this conversation in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Chagos Archipelago, home of the Chagosians, Diego Garcia, the largest island in the archipelago, is now the location of a very large U.S. military base.
UK government give our island to the U.S. government to make a military base and just deported all the Chagosian people from their country so they can't return back on the island.
Never.
But we are fighting. That's why we are fighting for the rights of return.
We do not consider that the right of self-determination actually applies to the Chagossians. And on the question of self-determination, the legal advice we've received is actually the Chagossians were not and are not a people.
For me, it's time to move on and see what we can do for the Chagossian community to return back home.
There's no support from the United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees.
United Nations don't care about Chagossian people.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Daniel Levy, a former Israeli peace negotiator and the president of the U.S. Middle East Project. Mr. Levy, before the break, we were talking about various forms of breaking international law. You mentioned the illegal Russian actions in Ukraine. And I think illegality is also, you know, it has many degrees to it. And I'm not asking you for any endorsement, moral endorsement, the endorsement of the Russian policy. I don't think Russia requires it at this point or can hope for that at this point of time. But contrasting or comparing Russian policy to that of Israel, Israel, as far as I know, has been trying over the last couple of decades to entrench itself on the Palestinian territories without formally annexing them and without formally taking responsibility for governing those territories properly, for granting the people their proper rights, their government services, you know, the ability to live their lives fully. And I think Russia made a different choice. It went for the annexation, which, again, I'm not asking you to endorse. But when it comes to international community, obviously, annexation is far more egregious. But is it the same for the people who live on those territories? Because as far as I'm concerned, I think it puts more onus, more responsibility onto the governance to provide something for those people.
Well, yes, you're right. You won't get the endorsement. But what I'm drawing attention to is when international law is broken. What I'm not drawing attention or suggesting is the same is these different situations. I think what is more similar is where areas have been targeted with a clear expectation of civilian casualties. I think the question of annexation and assuming responsibility, of course, it's also linked to what happens to the population in terms of has one encouraged forced population transfers, something Israel did with the Palestinians at the moment of its creation in the 1947 to 1949 wars. Does one take responsibility for the populations that one has annexed? And one can make cases about the difference with Crimea, for instance. And then one gets into the question of how does one understand the absence of that annexation on the question of Palestine? Jerusalem was illegally annexed. The Golan Heights, which is a situation between Israel and Syria, was illegally annexed. But as you point out, you have not seen the annexation of the West Bank. Partly that's an internal political disagreement inside Israel, but partly the way Israel worked its management of that situation was to create a Palestinian Authority, agree to the creation of that authority. And this is why I said the peace process is no longer fit for purpose, because over the years, what we've seen is that that Palestinian Authority has increasingly become not a voice for Palestinian liberation, but a subcontractor. So Israel doesn't have to pay, the donor community pays. Israel doesn't have to annex and take responsibility and say, if all these people are now annexed to my territory, do I give them equal rights? Do I formalize what organizations such as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International call a system of apartheid? And then the other dynamic, of course, is what is the global geopolitical context in which one is operating? Mm-hmm. Is it a context in which there is a very clear challenge to Russia's actions in Ukraine versus a very clear acquiescence mm-hmm. to Israel's actions in Palestine? And it's when you put all of those together that you begin to get a picture of, okay, what can be done in this specific situation?
Mm-hmm. Now, if I may draw one more parallel between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or stalemate and the war in Ukraine, I think ultimately both of them are about the issue of land, you know, historic land, who gets to live on that land, which language people are encouraged to speak, which culture or religion they are allowed to practice, and so on. Do you think the Israeli-Palestinian situation offers any lessons here on what to do and what not to do to minimize, first of all, the bloodshed and then historic hostility.
I mean, I would add to the mix of the factors you mentioned, Oksana, of course, power relations. I think it's too early to make a designation as to whether one has a balance of power in the Russia-Ukraine situation in terms of the extent, the longevity of Western backing for Ukraine. I simply don't know that we know yet, nor do I at least have a clear enough sense of how willing Russia will be to invest over what period of time, with what goals in mind in Ukraine. So I think one has to kind of ask those questions about power relations, and I think they're quite crucial. What I would say is that where there's a complete absence of balance, when there's such a huge asymmetry, and when the external intervention is to increase the asymmetry, and here I'm talking about the Palestine-Israel situation, of course, not the Russia-Ukraine situation, the idea that one can have two parties negotiating a solution from such positions of asymmetrical power, I think is a clear lesson from Israel-Palestine. Therefore, one has to level, to a degree at least, that asymmetry, so that Israel has a degree of accountability before one can expect the Israelis to move. If I can carry it over to the Russia-Ukraine situation, I think one of the things that I'm looking at there is the extent to which there is an absence of an attempt at politics and diplomacy. And that really worries me, because your question was lessen the bloodshed. Part of the answer is don't conduct military actions where there is such a clear likelihood of civilian casualties. But another part of the answer is keep the doors open to diplomacy, have those channels, and be working that track the whole time. And I fear that there is a real unwillingness to do that at the moment on the Ukraine crisis. And I fear that a part of that is coming in significant measure from the West.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking about the West, the United States is a potent player and the primary sponsor of one of the sides in both of these conflicts. And I understood that your position has been that the American policy is not the most conducive to peace, at least at this point of time. But I wonder if you could expand more on this sort of foothold policy, because both in Israel and in Ukraine, what the United States is trying to ensure is having a foothold onto a significant territory. And that is perhaps one of the reasons why there is no push on the Western side for peace, because they intend to secure that foothold for themselves. What could possibly encourage them to not necessarily let it go, but to agree that Ukraine could be a neutral territory, which I think would be quite satisfactory to Russia?
Look, in a way, it's of course almost the opposite dynamic working in each of these situations. I have my own view of how the relationship between NATO and the post-Soviet space was handled. I think this could have been avoided. I don't think Ukrainian membership of NATO was a serious enough prospect to have not offered clarity on. I do think that you could make the case in the Ukraine situation that had the West in that part of the world simply said, okay, it is what it is, we look the other way, that its standing would have been unprecedentedly weakened, given where we are talking about geographically, given the continued existence of NATO. I think the question in that scenario is, at what point does one transition into the kinds of compromises that will probably be necessary to bring this to a close. In the other situation, rather than saying, okay, here we have a party that is able to get away with this, how do we create a balance? It has absolutely recused itself from playing that role vis-a-vis the Palestinians. But I don't think it's about territory. I don't think it's about a foothold. And this is really important. I don't think those things apply to Israel-Palestine. I think what applies to Israel-Palestine is primarily, not only, but primarily domestic American politics, which is the always a factor, sometimes a dominant factor. It may be an important factor in holding back a diplomatic process in Ukraine. I don't think we know that yet. It is certainly a factor in why we have not seen Israel held to account and more prospect of peace in that area.
Now, if I may ask you one more question, which sort of, maybe those parallels are artificial and let me know about that, but I find sometimes the current Israeli politics and the current Ukrainian politics, domestic politics, very similar in a sense that there are a lot of hardliners who can really and almost deliberately use vitriolic rhetoric in order to win votes. And there is absolutely no political punishment for that. I think at some point it became a political necessity to be as hardline or xenophobic as you can be towards your neighbor in order to get to power. Now, do you think this political dynamic would have been in place in both Israel and Ukraine if it weren't for very powerful foreign backing? Do you think those countries would have been able to maintain this kind of political discourse, very divisive, full of hatred, if they were left to their own devices, if they had to manage their own security on their own?
So, first of all, I don't think that description of the drivers of an internal debate are unique to Ukraine or Israel. I don't think also they're not unique to Ukraine in that conflict, albeit in a different political scenario, but hardline rhetoric is certainly coming from at least both directions. Your specific question, I think, is important for both of the conflicts you'd refer to and well beyond those. And it's the question of moral hazard, as I would call it, which is if you have an external backer that gives the impression, at least, that they will have your back if you do things that are dangerously escalatory. And that's the moral hazard, that you are then more likely to do those things. And that's why your external backers would be well advised to not encourage you to indulge in overreach. Now, I would argue that it may well be too early to suggest that is in play in terms of Ukrainian dynamics and what Ukraine has faced in terms of the attack on Ukrainian sovereignty. I think after so many years, we can make a pretty clear designation that that is the case on the Israeli side. And so what you see is not Israel is under some kind of onslaught, but in the context of permanent occupation, you have still more extreme policies, narratives, rhetorics, vis-a-vis the Palestinians coming out of the Israeli government.
Mr. Levy, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Oksana.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.